My name is Clancy Imslund, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. You folks coming in, you missed all the highlights so far by the voice of the convention. I want to say one thing. I have a kind of reputation of being a kind of a crosspatch or a tough guy, and I'm not really. I'm just kind of a lamb inside, oozy and soft. And I was thinking tonight, if I had one day left to live, and someone asked me what I'd like to do, I said, I'd like to go to Lanier Island and see if I could get John to recreate his talk tonight. He would make that last day seem like forever. I'm glad our songstress Sonia got up. She said, I don't know what Clancy's going to talk about. Well, I don't know what you're saying about, so make sure it all works out. But this has been a good weekend, as it always is. I want to thank Dick and for inviting me. I very much enjoyed the meeting this afternoon here about relationships and AA's gift of AA and relationships. And I noticed that we have had several gifts of this and that in our program. And my job is to talk about the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know exactly what that means. But I know that Alcoholics Anonymous has one underlying secret that no one seems to know about, except everybody in AA knows about it. And I'll talk about that a little bit. And to talk about it, you have to go back in history a little bit. We go back to the days of Bill Wilson and, his trip to the hospital, the town's hospital, was his fourth trip he made there. First trip, he was young and sparkling. Second trip, he was a little older. And third trip, he was very drunk. And the fourth trip, he hated to go back because he always felt that Dr. Silkworth would be so disappointed in him after he had such a really good relationship with him. But he went back to his fourth relationship. Well, how he did that is kind of interesting. You know, Ebby called on him to as part of his therapy and the Oxford movement. He had testify to someone, and he decided to testify to Bill Wilson, who probably wouldn't remember it the next day. And so he went over there, and Bill talks about it in the book, how he opened the door, and Ebby was there clean and sharp. He said, Jesus, Ebby, you look good. And Ebby said, I found religion. That ended all value of that conversation to Bill. But they sat down, and Ebby talked, and Bill drank as fast as he could, and finally Ebby got tired of that and went home. And what is not in the book that he came back two or three days later, and he had the Oxford Group closer with him. Hi, Mr. Wilson, I want to talk to you about the Oxford Group. And Bill got drunker than ever, and that cheered us all up. So he went home, and that was the end of that. And some months later, Bill was sitting around moping one day and happened to think, I was really mean to Ebby that day. He was trying to help me. He had you doing something at the stupid Oxford Group. But he was trying to help me. I should really make amends to him. They say in the Oxford Group you should make amends. I should make amends to him. So he knew where Ebby lived in a mission down on Lower Broadway. He decided to go over there on Armistice Day of 1934 and make amends. He kind of got a little drunky-poo on the way to build up his confidence. And he got to the mission, and Ebby wasn't there. But he gave a short sermon anyway to help the folks. And staggered on down the street. And the next day, he went to the hospital. Not the next day, I guess a couple weeks later, on December 14th, he went in the hospital. And he hated to go in because he knew Dr. Silkworth would be so disappointed in him. But he went in, and Dr. Silkworth was very nice to him, hugged him, said, well, good to see you. He said, I think it's time for us to go to bed now, huh? Let's go. And we took him upstairs and put him to bed. And then he called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, I have some bad news for you. I think Bill will die before if he has another one of these drunks. He's just dying. He looks so terrible now. His reactions are bad. I think that any way you can stop him from drinking, his life is on the line. And that panicked her, and she got a hold of Ebby at the mission. She had his number, and Ebby came up to the hospital with a couple of Oxford Group guys, and Ebby said, Bill, you've got to find a power greater than yourself. And Bill said, oh, don't give me that religious crap. I don't want to hear that. So they said, okay, they went home. And we all know the story. In the middle of the night, this ne'er-do-well, drunken, nothing, woke up in the middle of the night, and his heart was pounding. He knew he was going to die. If there's no God out there, show yourself! And all of a sudden, the lights came on like somebody throwing a switch. And nobody throwing a switch. There was nobody in the room. And a wind came through the windows that were closed. What the hell is this? And he realized he was going insane. But he felt pretty good. And then after a while, the wind stopped and the lights went out. And he slept well that night for the first time in a long time. In the morning, he told the doctor, but here's what happened to me. Am I going insane? The doctor looked at him and said, no, I don't know what it is that happened to you, Bill, but whatever it was, hang on to it. You look like a different man. And he came out of there and he went to the Oxford group, as we know, because that's where Ebby associated him with being sober, is the Oxford group. And let me just for a moment give you a little history of the Oxford group. This is cute. In 1908, a minister in Pennsylvania came to the conclusion that the trouble with Christianity today is that people were getting too loose in it. They weren't vibrant and determined as they used to be. So he said, God, the people used to be crucified for their faith. Now they won't even come to church if it's raining. What the hell's wrong with people? And so he started the First Century Christian Association to have the strength and drive that the people in the first century had. And of course, he didn't get many members. Nobody. I don't want to be crucified this week, Doctor. Thank you very much. And after the First World War, he went to Europe and tried to talk it up. And he got a few people, not very many, but of all places, Oxford University. Oh, what a wonderful therapy. That's just what we need. Everybody just went crazy over it. So much so that it became known as the Oxford Group. And he brought it back to America with the help of the Oxford Group in the 1920s. So about the early 1930s, it really was at its peak. But it wasn't as the way he'd started it. He'd started it as determined, and it had evolved into people, nice people, better type people, meeting in one another's homes and talking about how they could enhance their spiritual values. And that's what the Oxford Group turned out to be, and it ran that way for a long time. In fact, I don't know if you ever know what happened to it. The doctor who started it became very impacted by the precision and strength of Germany in the late 1930s. That if we could just get our area working like the way they do, the trains run on time and everybody does well. Here we can't even get the meetings to start on time. So he went to Germany and they decorated him for his approval and so on. And the Oxford people were so upset by this that they said, you can't use our name anymore. So they changed their name to the Moral Rearmament Organization. If you've ever heard of that, the Moral Rearmament is the old Oxford group and just about dead now. But it continued, and Dr. Buckman's idea was that, well, the whole world is rearming. Maybe if we just rearm morally, we'll be superior. But it didn't do much. But anyway, Bill went to the Oxford group, stayed sober, and he said, I think I have a calling to help drunkards. That's what I have, a calling to help drunkards. And he'd go to the Oxford group almost every day. And he'd pick up some street drunk on the way, some slatternly, smelly, ugly, sickening street drunk, and take him to these meetings of nice people. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe, sir. And you'd take him home if they had no place to go. One guy committed suicide in his home, Bill's house, apartment. One morning after about 6 months of this, Bill got up and he was going to get a cup of coffee, but he realized the coffee pot was gone. The guy he'd brought home was gone last night. So he knew he'd taken the coffee pot to sell it for wine, probably. And he was very cross about that. And he noticed his wife putting on her sweater. She worked as a counter girl in a cheap department store in the basement. And she'd been quite a sleek society deb when he married her. And he realized he'd brought her down to this level, kind of a pudgy black and white hair, and kind of lost her zip. And she was putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve. She was really working in this cheap department store and making enough money to pay the rent so Bill could go to the Oxford group. And Bill said, "Lois, I'm so sorry. I thought I had a calling to help drunkards, but obviously I don't. The guy I brought home last night stole a coffee pot, for God's sakes. I've been working with people for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober, and I'm done doing it. I'm going to get a job tomorrow for shoveling dirt and get you out of that damn department store." And right there, your life and mine hung by a thread just about that big. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her 40 years ago up in Connecticut. I said, "How did you ever think that answer, Lois? You just changed the course of history." He said, "Not one person has stayed sober." She said, "You did." He said, "Oh. That's why Oldheimer's don't have a chair in front. You just go, oh, oh, oh." And so he continued trying. And we continued towards our goal. But he was very despondent. He went down to see the doctor at the hospital where he'd been. See Dr. Silkworth, his friend, his chum. And he said, "Doc, I don't know what it is. I've been trying to help people for 6 months. And I've really been talking to them. And not one person stayed sober." The doctor said, "Well, what did you try to tell them, Bill?" "Well, I've been trying to teach them to have a spiritual experience." So, "Well, you're screwed there, I'll tell you that." He said, "Alcoholic..." He went on later to write about it, and he talked about how he described alcoholics to Bill as kind of a sheath of invisible plastic of some sort that kept everything out. Advice, any sort of good hearing. "Thanks a lot for that advice, really appreciate it." you can't get through to them. And that mask is called, "But you don't understand, my case is different." The universal defense of every alcoholic. And the doctor said to him, "Why don't you got an idea, Bill? I'm not an alcoholic, and I get along with these guys to a point." And he really did. He really chummed up with his patients, and they all loved him. But they always knew he didn't understand. He said, "If I'm not an alcoholic, so I can't do this, but maybe you can do it. Tell them that you used to be a drunk. Tell them that you used to be a drunk and you're in bad shape and now you're sober. Maybe that'll help. Break down part of that wall." And Bill said, "That's the worst advice I ever got." And went home, to hell with that. But he found a letter at home, and a letter from Wall Street saying, "We see that you've been sober for quite a while now, Bill," and took us to the next stage of our development. I said, "We're trying to get a hold of a machine tool company that manufactures rubber machine tools in Akron, Ohio. We're trying to get the proxies, and you're a good, great proxy man. Would you go out there and see if you get these proxies? And we'll pay you well, and if we can do it, we'll get a corporation out there, and you'll be president, and you'll be on easy street for the rest of your life." And Bill thought, "Oh, God, here's my big chance to break loose of all this tawdry poverty I've been living in, living off people." So he went to Akron, as we all know, told his wife he'd come back a champion, told his friends, "I've got my chance now, I'm going to break through." And the letter said, if anything happens that doesn't work out, or you blow this, don't even bother coming back to us, because you're done here." So he wasn't going to do that. So he went out there, and the deal blew up. It wasn't his fault, but it made no difference. The deal blew up. And one Saturday in May of 1934, he'd been sober 5 months, 6 months, and he stood in the lobby of the Hotel Mayflower. He reached his pocket, he had $10. And I can either pay my hotel or I can buy a train ticket home. But God, I don't want to go home. All those people I have to face again, admit I'm a failure and a loser. And I don't know if I can even stay sober through this. It's just terrible. And as he wrote later, a few years ago, I stood in that same spot in about 1970. And I tried to recreate those emotions. I couldn't, because it wasn't happening to me. But over there, there was a door with a curved sign over it said cocktails in orange. And he said, as he stood there, and heard the sounds of clinking glasses and laughter coming out of that door, and girlish laughter. And he had a great thought. It's a thought that I would have had, I suppose you would have had, maybe. The thought was, if I could just have a couple drinks, I could think of the answer to this problem. Just a couple drinks. He started to go. And about 3-4 steps, you and I were in our grave, I'll tell you. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw across the lobby some payphones on the wall. To you young folks, these are kind of big cell phones. And then, and you go over to him and you go like this, and nothing at all happens. You have to put it in a nickel. Then, but he remembered he had promised his friends in the Oxford group that he would call someone before he did anything drastic. And he went over the phones, and behind the phones, as there was then in most all pay phones in smaller towns, and still is for all I know, a list of the local biggest churches and their ministers and their phone numbers. So if you're a wayward Christian, you could call someone and get a little help. So we called the first number. He said, "My name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York. I got to talk to somebody in the Oxford group." The man said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And he said, "I'm trying to read a sermon. Please don't bother me." And hung up. That'd have been all for me. Screw you, doctor. But he called the next number and got no answer, and called the next number and got no answer. Called the next man. The man said, I'd like to help you, sir, but I'm not particularly involved in the Oxford group at all, so I can't help you, but I wish you well. And that was the end of it. He started back to get his two drinks. He noticed one last name down there, a funny little name. Walter Tunk. Walter Tunk. And he thought, Jesus, I don't want to be rejected. I shouldn't be rejected by Walter Tunk. I don't want to miss that chance. So we called Walter Tunk, and Walter Tunk happened to be the only person, probably in Akron, that could have helped him at that moment. Just a really great AA miracle. And Dr. Tunk said, "Funny you should call, sir. One of my parishioners, whose picture is right over there in the middle of that bank of five, called me. And she said that in her Oxford group this week, their doctor had admitted he was a drunkard and he couldn't do anything about it. And they've been praying incessantly for him ever since, but he gets drunker and drunker. And maybe I can get a hold of his wife and have you talk to him. I'll have to go through my parishioner." And so she said, "Wait there," and called the parishioner, who called Mrs. Smith. And here's a little known fact. It rang. And it rang, and it rang, and it rang. And he's just hanging up when he heard a voice say, "Hello, I'm sorry, I was out in the yard." And they got talking. That probably 5 seconds saved our lives. And she said, "Yes, I would like to have the doctor talk to this man from New York. He can't do it today, he's drunk under the coffee table. But maybe I can sober him by tomorrow." So they made a plan. Parishioner got the phone number of this goof from New York and called him. "I'd like to have you come out to my home in West Akron. Here's how you get there in the streetcars you take," and so forth. And the next day, they all were going to meet at the parishioner's house, her house. And they had a little bite to eat, a little collation. And the doctor and this failed Wall Street man went into a side room for a talk for 10 minutes. But the interesting thing, you know, in 1980 at the International Convention, we all had a great thrill because at the last meeting, the leader said, "We have a special guest here tonight, Dr. Bob's son." And he walked out, we all didn't even know he had a son, young Bob. But of course, he was married to an Al-Anon. No, he was married to an alcoholic, is what I mean to say. And he became an Al-Anon later. But anyway, he got very active in Al-Anon. From then on, he was very active in helping people because he could talk about those days from personal experience. And one of his favorite stories was the day they drove out to the parishioner's house, mansion, in West Akron. His dad was too sick to drive, so he had to drive. He was 16. And the front seat, his sister sat there. In the back, his mother and father. And all the way out there, the doctor said, I'll give this guy 10 minutes, and but I'm going to give him, not listen to some anymore damn lectures. I've heard all the lectures I can stand about my drinking. I refuse to listen anymore. But I'll give him, I know today's Mother's Day, and I ruined Mother's Day for you, but I'll make it better for you. I'll give him 10 minutes. So after their collation, they went to a room and came out several hours later. Several hours. And the doctor said to his wife, "My God, Ann, that's the first man I ever talked to who seems to know how I feel and how I feel when I drink and how I feel when I try to stay sober. My God." And apparently he'd done what the doctor downtown in New York had told him to do. He identified himself as a drinker. And Dr. Bob was so impressed. And Dr. Bob said, Could you stay with us a couple of weeks? I know you got very busy in New York, but perhaps you could stay with us. I want to talk a little bit longer." And Bill thought, "Let's see. I have nowhere to get out of town. Yes, I can stay." So they stayed. And they talked for 2 weeks incessantly about the Oxford Group and how they could enhance their spiritual values. Dr. Blossom just blossomed forth. So wonderful at last. And he said, "Bill, this weekend, I'm going to ask you to stay just a couple more days. I'm going to New York, or to Atlantic City, for the American Medical Association National Convention. I was there last year and I was so drunk and they all ridiculed me and poked fun at me and treated me like a piece of dirt. I want them this year to see how I am, really, sober and sharp and alert." And Bill said, "Okay." And the doctor said, "I'll be back Tuesday morning." So off he went, and everybody, oh boy, isn't this nice? Tuesday morning, the phone rang early, and woman on the phone said, "Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry, but they carried the doctor off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And I guess the big experiment didn't work. But the station agent knew that I worked for him, so he called me. This is his office nurse. And I got a cab driver, and we lugged him up to his office. He's here on the floor of his office. He's crying, and he's so sorry. But it didn't work. And I'm so sorry, Mrs. Smith." Mrs. Smith said, "Well, we're very sorry, too, but I'll take Mr. Wilson. We'll come down and get him and bring him home." So she went down, and they brought this drunken bum home in the car. He cried all the way. I know very few things that are more sickening to me than crying drunk. God, they're sickening. "I'm so sorry." "Now you're sorry, you son of a bitch." But they took him home and put him to bed. And a couple days later, he sat up and said, "What day is it?" "It's Thursday, Bob." "Oh, my God. I've got to do a cancer surgery today. Look at my hand. I can't hold a knife." And so his new friend Bill went and got him some beer just to steady his nerves. And off he went to the hospital to do his cancer surgery. He said, "I'll be home about 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock came and he didn't come. 3 o'clock came and he didn't come. 4 o'clock came and he didn't come. 5 o'clock came. Son of a bitch was drunk again, of course. 6 o'clock, the door opened, and there was Bob, sober, cold sober. "Where you been, Bob?" He said, "When I was doing that surgery, suddenly struck me that Oxford group wants me to make amends to people for my mistakes. But I never thought that applied to doctors. But it turns out I'm a human being before I'm a doctor. So I've been all day, all over Akron, making amends to people. And I feel wonderful. And that turned out to be the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. And nobody knew it was the birthday, of course, just two old fools trying to stay sober. But neither one of them ever drank again. That was June 10th, 1935. And they realized that Dr. Bob had not stayed sober. And Bill remembered all the people he talked to about spirituality had not stayed sober. There must be a... apparently we have to talk about it, Bob. Bob, you have to try to help somebody. He said, okay, I'm ready to try it. In those days, alcoholics or people with alcoholism could not get into hospitals. They didn't want any drunken bums in hospitals. You'd have to have a physical problem, some arteriosclerosis or some rotten thing. But Bob knew that there were some people who were physically sick, also terrible drunks, and he called the hospital to talk to his friend, Sister Ignatia. He'd been left the staff up there sometime before that because of his drinking. And she said, yes, well, I have a guy here. He's a lawyer from Louisville, moved here a few years ago, and he's been a terrible drunk. And he's in terrible shape, and I'll try to, if you'd like, I'll have you talk to him. I'll have to talk to his wife. And that's Bill Dotson, wherever he might be, hiding around in here somewhere.
Right there.
Right there.
Over here.
Over here? Yeah, over there. Last guy on this bank of five. I knew that. I heard him talk a long time ago, years ago. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. And my wife came in and said, two men want to talk to me about drinking. And I said, absolutely not. I am sick of talking to people about drinking. I'm so tired of it, it makes me want to drink. I'm not going to talk to anybody. Don't ever try to bring them in. He said, but my wife's a strong woman. So I talked to those two fellas. And they never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I thought to myself, my God, I'm not the only one. There are others like me. And he became number three. And they went out, he got out of the hospital, and they worked together trying to drum up trade from drunks. Nobody really wanted interest in going to the Oxford group. The trouble with the Oxford group is that you could talk about how you felt and how you drank, but if you go there, all you wanted to talk about was Jesus, and that'd make him get him drunk. And but they, one side story I always loved is they found there was a young guy, Ernie, who started to go around with them, but he was only 29. They said, you can't be an alcoholic, Ernie, you're too young, but you certainly drink like one. So come along with us. And he came along with him, got to be friends with everybody, and fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. And without knowing it, brought us our first relationship. I don't know a word that sends a sponsor's spine colder than that word. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh, Jesus. What you need is a phone that says, yeah. And it's kind of a touching thing. And they really fell in love and they got married. Really, isn't that touching? That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, when she was young, 19 or 20, fell in love with the guy I sponsored who was 5 years sober, who was not a nice man. He was getting there, but it could be a long run. And I was dead set against their marriage. But I have a family full of daughters, all of whom are much wiser than I am. In fact, today someone was talking about they had three daughters, or three children who were alcoholics. You, Bob. I have three daughters who are Alcoholics Anonymous members, and they're all 27 now. And they've learned more in their 27 years than I've ever learned. They tell me about it. And But my daughter's decided that she's going to get married. And then I'll tell you the absolute epitome of mixed emotions. Watching your daughter to go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything because that's the sacredness of the... But you can give hints. Let me know if you ever bring your sheep home. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm very funny to you, and that one's funny to me. And they told Ernie, now Ernie, you're a husband now. You're a father. You're going to be a father. Stay home. Stay home. We'll comb the streets and go to the Oxford group meetings. And if we need you, we'll call you. But you stay home and take care of things. So he did. Stayed home and took care of things until he got drunk. And didn't sober up again for 50 years. And young Bob told us he'd run into Ernie. And Ernie said, yes, I've been sober a year. That was just 50 years later. But anyway, they got married. And Bill went back to New York in a month or two and got AA going there. Not very fast. The next year they had, to the best of their knowledge, 5 sober people in New York. 5. By the next year they had a bunch more. They had a guy who put in some clout for him, Dr. Town. Dr. Town from the Town Hospital. He thought, one of the great things about Bill Wilson, you'll hear from time to time, that he didn't really have any spiritual experience, just a natural reaction to the therapy of
Belladonna.
What are you giving the talk up here? What is this? I would have thought of it by nightfall. Belladonna. They said, well, Belladonna gives you those kind of illusions. But then you got to remember, the hospital handled about 600 drunks a year. They just shot him through. And Bill was the only one, he's the only recorded history of having that kind of an experience. You know, that's kind of an interesting thing, too, when the doctor told him when he went down there to see what he did, was doing wrong. The doctor said, why do you come here? We have no answer for you. No one has any answer for you. We get you guys sober. 3-4 weeks, you're back here drunk. That's all. There's no answer. No answer to alcoholism in the world that we know of. Just if you can stay sober, God bless you. And so being sober was really a rarity. And the doctor Towns of Town Hospital says, Bill used to go down there and kind of mill around with these guys and try to teach them a little bit about sobriety. And I don't want any of that spiritual stuff here. This is a problem of a mind and body. And your spiritual stuff is not going to work. And as the years went by, he really became a great fan of Bill and offered him a job finally down there. I've often thought about that. This is the height of depression. Bill could not pay his rent, had no money, had nothing. Offered him $700 a month, which was a lot then, which turned out, he said, next year we'll give you $12,000 a month. And Bill answered to a prayer. And he told the people in his group about it, the 5-6 people. They said, you can't do that, Bill. You'll be selling AA. And so he had to give it up. Went back to being broke forever. But it was a touching, touching thing. They got Bill Dotson, the guy in the hospital, and they got a few others. They talked to him about, tell about their experiences. And in fact, they got rather good at it. They got a pretty good group of people in the Oxford group. And the head of the Oxford group, the guy whose home they met in, finally sent a letter to Bill Wilson saying, please don't have your people come here to our meetings anymore. We're here for spiritual growth. All they want to talk about is getting drunk. So we had exchange, and they moved to the King Street School, where Dr. Bob started the first AA meeting as such. And young Bob said, that's true, we're talking about it before the meeting. Young Bob Smith said, if Bill had been the only founder of AA, he would have franchised it and sold it in 1938. If my dad had been the only AA founder, we'd still be meeting in the King Street School. But between them, they have one pulling and one pushing. They had a great life. And the miracle of AA continued, the great gift of AA, which nobody thought about much, except, and we hear about it every day, and we don't take it for granted. But the great miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, the great gift of AA continued, and little by little AA grew, as we all know. And in 1945, Bill Wilson began to notice that 44 or 43, AA was dying out. After the Saturday Post article, thousands of people had written in, and there's AA meetings everywhere. But by 1942, he's starting to get, don't send us any more literature, we're closed. And by 1945, AA was on the edge of, almost on the edge of extinction. They were just dying 10, 20, 30 groups a day. And he read their letters, and he started the grapevine. He thought maybe that'll help. Started that in 1944, the big size, and didn't help much. And a doctor in New York, in North Carolina, wrote an article for the Grapevine. Said, you know anything about these guys? Here's an interesting story, Bill. And he told him about the Washingtonians. We know about that. That's in our book. But in 1841, 1842, there was an old drunk, six drunks in Baltimore. One had just got out of jail again. He went back to his pals and said, ah, those guys said they understood how I feel. They don't know how I feel. You're the only guys that know how I feel. Those guys don't. They just give me lectures. They said, well, we seem to know how each other feel. Maybe if we could keep each other sober for a while, when we feel a drink, we'll talk to you. And so they started a little group called the Washingtonians, and everybody laughed at that. You can't keep yourself sober. You're going to help each other stay sober. But they stayed sober. And so much so that it became quite famous. People came from Washington, went back, started a Washingtonian movement in Washington. People came from Philadelphia. People came from Boston. That really took off in Boston for some reason. New York, a lot of cities. After about 2 years of this, they were doing very well. But the only problem was people saw them as kind of screwballs, you know. So we have to have people realize how well we're doing. And so they had taken as their anniversary, Washington's birthday. It really wasn't, but it was nice to comfortable. They said, on our next birthday, our second birthday, invite someone locally in who's a up-and-coming guy and who will see what we're like and go out and tell the people that we're doing such a good job. So all over the country, February 22nd, 1942, people came into the Washingtonians. In Illinois, the speaker was, Springfield, Illinois, was a guy named Abraham Lincoln, young lawyer. If you ever read your books, collection of Lincoln speeches, there's one to the Washingtonians, Springfield, Illinois. And he gives a long talk, just boiler talk. But near the end, he says, I have worked with all you men, and I know you quite well, but I cannot understand your thirst, this terrible thirst you seem to have had, but you don't have it anymore, and you're doing a making splendid life. And went on, and the Washingtonians grew just quickly all over. By 1845, they thought they might have had 100,000 sober drunkards in America. And the leaders got together, and they thought, God, we've helped about all the drunkards that are available out there. Maybe we should help other people. Maybe people with narcotic problems, not cocaine and heroin like today, but stuff that they had then. And maybe we should help people with emotional problems. We can maybe straighten them out. Maybe we can help each other, have people to talk to each other and help them. So the guys went out and they began helping everybody. And I had a book home written in 1851 by one of the few survivors. And he talked about, God, we're doing so well, but pretty soon we didn't talk to drinkers anymore. We talked with all kinds of problems, and people just get drunk around us. And by 1849, to all intents and purposes, the Washingtonians were extinct, all died drunk. The biggest downfall of all time. And Bill read about that in that article. He got some books in the library on the Washingtonians that, my God, their battles were over the same reasons I'm getting in these letters from all over the country. Prestige, and who's going to get the most ink, and who's going to get to be the most famous, and who's going to get paid, and who's not going to get paid, and on and on. So he sat down in the last gasp effort to save AA in 1945, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions, long after AA started. And he wrote them in the long form. Most of you know about that. In case you're new, in the back of the book, there's 12 traditions short form and 12 traditions long form. And long form is really the basic of it all because it really describes what it's about. We read them in our group in Los Angeles, second Wednesday of every month. And we've heard them a lot, but they still are good to listen to. And he issued these traditions one by one in the new grapevine, and people raised hell about it. We're not here for any rules. We're here for love, goddammit. And so people didn't really want to accept them. Very many people didn't. So Bill got in his motorcycle, put his wife in the sidecar, and drove up and down the East Coast talking to people in groups. These are not rules. These are suggestions to save us. Didn't do much good. And eventually they thought, we're going to have to get people from all over the country to understand this. And Bill and Dr. Babo got along together, but their followers in Akron and New York didn't get along. People in Akron said, oh, they're a bunch of city slickers in New York. People in New York, oh, there's a bunch of shit kickers in Akron. But Bill and Dr. Babo got along well, and they got together and said, these people won't go to Akron, they won't go to New York, Cleveland. So in 1950, the first large group of sober alcoholics of our type got together in Cleveland. And I have the tape somewhere in my house of that meeting. I've listened to it a couple of times. And it's very interesting. Most of the speakers were not alcoholics. Most of them were leaders, social leaders of one kind or another. Warden of Sing Sing, the warden of prison in California, people in the government talking about how good the Alcoholics Anonymous, how good the people were. And Dr. Bob. Bill talked on Friday night, as he did for all the conventions, international conventions, and Dr. Bob spoke on Sunday afternoon. He was dying. He said, Bob, you probably don't want to talk, do you? He said, oh, I've got to talk. He said, I've been sober 15 years. I got the second oldest sobriety in the world. And he always was a much better 12-stepper than Bill was. And he got up, and he knew he was dying, and he knew he had to communicate something to save AA. And he started off just nonsense. Not nonsense, but not very thrilling. You know, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your groups that we all get out of AA what we put into it. And I want to apologize for my ill health. I've been in the bed the last several months. My health hasn't returned the way I hoped it would. And he said, and on and on like that. And give about 5 or 6, 7 minutes of just talk that you'd hear. But then, he said, I'd like to call your attention to 2 or 3 things. And he gave then what many people consider to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And we all know what that means. We pretend we don't, but we all do. When things are going our way, but love is the answer, baby. But let somebody cross us or thwart us. Funny thing is, all of us spent many years of our life fighting the label alcoholic. But in AA, the worst thing you can say about somebody, I don't even think that son of a bitch is alcoholic. And finally he said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a pat on the back, take us to a few meetings. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency. We are too busy to help our fellow man who still suffers in the blackness of alcoholic despair. Then he sat down and was dead shortly thereafter, a few months later. And it's as true today as it was in 1950, or it will be as true forever. We are here for love and service. And all over the world, people try to change AA. And right now, there's a lawsuit going on in Toronto. There's a man suing Alcoholics Anonymous because they would. He and his friends, took the 12 steps in the book, took all mention of God out of them, and wanted to be listed in the phone 24, you know, on their meeting list. And of course, the meeting said, "We don't, whatever you got there, it isn't AA. We can't give you list you." So they're suing him in the court. It's going on and on, costing a lot of money to a lot of people. But it's been going that way for years. I remember an atheist group in Denver, and they went on and on. And all of a sudden, somebody's going to change AA. Nobody ever seems to realize, change it if you must, but don't call it AA. Then it isn't AA anymore. It's whatever you think it is, but it's not AA. But the AA, as it is, continues to work. And it's now grown into, 150 countries or something like that? And over a couple of million sober alcoholics, we just take it for granted. And you know what the gift of AA is? The secret of AA nobody ever pays any attention to. Anonymity. Of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to get through that wall. To get through that wall of, but you don't understand. And when, my God, you do understand. And I fought AA for almost 10 years. I was in and out all over the country. And I sneered at it intellectually, could really destroy it if I could. Because AA is just a bunch of goofs sitting around. I never realized. I left my wall up and that's what they were. When a guy got through that wall to me in Los Angeles, I thought, my God, that's what I am. I'm an alcoholic. And it changed my life. I've been an alcoholic now for 57 years, and it's working great. And but I hear the same crap among new people that I used to peddle. And you can't really say, get out of here! Hang around, talk to somebody. Maybe somebody will one day open that wall. And so the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, it seems to me, is the gift of ability to get through that wall. Nothing else in history has ever seemed to do it satisfactorily. Today we see in the paper every day ads of, you don't have to go do 12 steps in Los Angeles anyway. We have in our treatment center, we got better ways to do it. And pills to take to relieve you of the need to drink and all this baloney. And none of it ever works. They all get drunk. Seems to. They come out of the treatment centers and these movie stars and a week later they're drunk again. And nobody ever says anything, but he took treatment. Because the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is that you and I find a place where we belong. What a gift that is. I'm sure if you're like me, you never had a place where you really belong because you're always that drunken son of a bitch. And now you're that sober guy, that sober woman, that sober somebody who lives with some degree of comfort. In the long form of the traditions, Bill wrote in the last form of the tradition, it deals with anonymity. But it really deals with everything here. We should. Why do we do these things? This to the end, that our great blessings shall never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful gratitude to Him who presides over us all. Thank you.